Thank you very much, Leslie, and thanks everyone for showing up. The Exodus is right over here in case you need it. I thought I would tell you two facts about Leslie that are not as widely known as perhaps they should be. These aren't scary facts. One of them is that Leslie was in the astronaut program for many years and rather narrowly missed being fired into space. The other interesting fact is that she also used to play professional volleyball. And I managed in one-on-one volleyball yesterday, beach volleyball down on the beach yesterday, I managed to score a point. So I feel pretty good today. I feel pretty good. All right. Now, The person I want to tell you about today, Kirtley Mather, was a geologist at Harvard University from the mid-1920s down through the 1970s, a very long career at Harvard, after a short career at Denison University in Ohio, which was his undergraduate alma mater, where he finished 2 years. He also spent 2 years as an undergrad at University of Chicago and then went back to Chicago for grad school. Now, the context, to give you some background about the lecture itself. Right, okay, and then this one, to advance it, same as a Mac, as a PC. Okay, I'm not Mac friendly, unfortunately. There's a longer version of this in the September 2011 issue of Zygon. And one reason the article was published in Zygon, and one reason I sent it to Zygon, is because two of Mather's best friends were co-founders of the Institute of Religion and Age of Science, which is the organization that publishes Zygon. I'll mention them later in the lecture. 2001. That's the 2001 issue because I couldn't find a nice digital photo of the 2011, and I didn't have time to take one myself. So, nice call. It's sharp eyes. But the cover is the same color. And you can ask me about that later if you want a copy. Now, the reason I got interested in Mather is because he wrote a pamphlet, a shirt pocket-sized pamphlet, you know, fit in a tract, you might call it, called The Religion of a Geologist that was published in 1931 by an outfit calling itself the American Institute of Sacred Literature, which was a correspondence school for Protestant pastors operated out of the University of Chicago Div School down through the middle of World War II when it went defunct. It was central to the mission of the University of Chicago, central to it, the whole university, because it had been founded by William Rainey Harper, a Hebrew scholar who used to teach at the old Morgan Park Theological Seminary in Chicago, took it with him to Yale Divinity School when he moved to Yale in the 1880s. And then he became the first president of the University of Chicago and went from Yale back to Chicago. So took it with him. So when, you know, Harper started this, when he went back to Chicago, he took it with him. You know this was very important to the University of Chicago. There's a long series of these pamphlets. It turns out there's 10 of them that I've written about as part of a long project that's now wrapping up. And I've discussed these before at ASA meetings, but I've never talked specifically about Kirtley Mather. He's the last of the scientists I've been studying as a way of wrapping up the project. To read about the project as a whole, which I will not be discussing today, I'll just be looking at Mather, there's an article about this in American Scientist several years ago, and there's a much longer, some of the other authors of these pamphlets are shown here, a few of the other authors. And there's a much longer version of this article with many more details and with images of fundamentalist cartoons on evolution as well in a book that was edited by the late Paul Boyer and Charles Cohen for University of Wisconsin Press a number of years ago. It's primarily church historians who would see something like that. I imagine most of you would ignore a piece of book on a topic like this, but that's where the long version of the essay is located. And I'm now completing an edition of all 10 of these pamphlets, getting close, I hope, to landing an academic publisher for that. Now, let me introduce then Kurt Lee Mather to you. Recent events in the United States have reminded us of the importance of questions about how scientific knowledge relates to religious knowledge. Can nature or the science of nature give us moral values? What does science have to say to religion about the origin of values such as altruism? Few American scientists have devoted as much time and effort to these questions as geologist Kurt Lee Mather. Mather's writings and activities over a period of 6 decades advanced the mutual relevance of religion and science for the modern age. Responding to anti-evolutionism during the 1920s, which was the decade of the Scopes trial, he taught Sunday school classes at the Newton Center Baptist Church near Cambridge. He did this for decades and brought in Harvard faculty and visiting dignitaries to give talks to this class, which grew to over 100 people in regular attendance. He also substantially assisted the defense at the Scopes trial. In fact, he was the person who suggested that expert witnesses for defending evolution and defending a positive relationship between evolution and religion be brought to Dayton to testify. And then he got invited to testify as one of these people himself. He also wrote the book Science in Search of God, published in 1928, which was in the early years, the very first year, really, I think, of the Religion Book of the Month Club. And this was one of the big selections. And it outsold selections by other distinguished authors, such as Arthur Eddington and Michael Pupin at Columbia. Pupin was a Pulitzer Prize winner for his autobiography earlier in the decade. Over the next 40 years, he explored the place of humanity in the universe and the presence of values in light of what he often called the administration of the universe, a term and concept he borrowed from the great Chicago geologist Thomas Crowley Chamberlain. Human values, including cooperation and altruism, had emerged in such a context. The administrative directive toward orderly organization of increasingly complex systems transcends the urge for survival, he wrote. Mather was also active in the early years of the Institute on Religion in an Age of Science, an organization created by his good friends Ralph Wendell Burho and Harlow Shapley. A descendant of Richard Mather, father of Increase Mather and the grandfather of Cotton Mather, Kurt Lee Mather was born in Chicago on February 18, 1888. Upon graduation from the South Chicago High in June 1904, Mather was awarded a full scholarship for his first year at the University of Chicago, which had only recently been founded. In his sophomore year, he took a geology course taught by physical geographer Wallace Walter Atwood, who later taught at Harvard before becoming the president of Clark University. And then the next summer, he went on a field course with Atwood in Wisconsin, and he continued to work with Atwood as a graduate student. Now, the geology department at Chicago had been organized by Thomas Crowder Chamberlain, who had recently proposed a novel theory of the planetary origin of the solar system with astronomer F.R. Moulton, challenging the nebular hypothesis of Simon Laplace that had been generally accepted since the early 19th century. If you don't know this, some of you know this name. If you don't know this name, this is one of the greatest geologists in America in the 19th century, Thomas Crowder Chamberlain. And you can look him up. And you can see this for yourself. He's also one of the early proponents of the idea of climate change and global warming through the use of fossil fuels. And Kurt Lee Mather wrote a paper about this in Science in around 1918. I'm not going to talk about that, but my paper talks about that if you'd like to see that. Chamberlain influenced Mather profoundly. Nearly 50 years later, Mather said that a portrait of Chamberlain is, quote, the only picture of any individual that hangs over my desk in my study at home. I don't know if it was this portrait or not. Chamberlain's father was a Methodist circuit rider who left North Carolina because he hated slavery. He held an Arminian theological position that gave humans a crucial role in participating with God in salvation and in acting redemptively in the world through morally upright conduct, thereby taking charge of their own destiny. His son, fully embraced this moral vision. The son, of course, is Thomas Chamberlain. Thomas Chamberlain wrote in the journal Science in 1924 as follows. Man's future career is chiefly a matter of his own making. We may then rationally regard the study of the earth's existing resources, as well as the development of man's capacities to use them and making the most of himself, as one of the potential factors in his own destiny. Now, unfortunately, I don't have time here to explain Chamberlain's religious ideas more fully, as I do in the published version of the paper. I'm going to jump back to Mather. During his final year at Chicago, the Mathers, that is Curtly Mather and his young wife, found a new church home near the university, Hyde Park Baptist Church, which is now called Hyde Park Union Church, where the pastor was Charles Whitney Gilkey, father of the late theologian Langdon Gilkey, and later the first dean of the chapel at the University of Chicago. The chapel was a gift, was the last gift to the university by John David Rockefeller, Sr., who had founded the university in the first place by making large gifts. The university and the Div School, his last big gift is the chapel, and after Rockefeller died, it was named for Rockefeller. Hyde Park was an extraordinarily ecumenical and very liberal church, almost an extension of the secular Temple of Learning a few blocks away. Members included the founder of the founding president, William Rainey Harper, and some of the leading exponents of the modernist wing of American Protestantism, such as the radical theologian George Berman Foster, a close friend of Clarence Darrow. In fact, Darrow delivered the eulogy at Foster's funeral. Gerald Burney Smith, who taught a course on science and religion at Chicago, one of the very few such courses taught in America at the time. There were a lot of courses on psychology of religion taught at seminaries. I won't go into that further, but that was a common occurrence. But courses on science and religion per se were not common at that time. And then Shaler Matthews, who was the dean of the Divinity School for a quarter century and was certainly the most important modernist theological educator in the United States. When Nobel laureate Arthur Compton succeeded fellow Nobel laureate Robert Millikan in the physics department a few years later, the Comptons also joined Hyde Park, but Mather was no longer in Chicago when Compton arrived. Now, the modernists deeply felt that Christian doctrine, including a classical understanding of God, had to be wholly accommodated to evolution in order for the Christian faith to be credible in a modern age. Consequently, the modernists typically spoke of God as always working within nature and humanity, and never outside of or apart from nature, like the transcendent creator and redeemer of traditional Christian theology. Jesus, for them, was a supreme example of a morally upright person who had loved self-sacrificially, there's the altruism, not the God who had literally taken on human form in order to save us from our sin. Indeed, salvation lay within ourselves, for God was understood to be imminent within us, no less than in the rest of nature, and we could bring about the kingdom of God on earth by following Jesus and spreading God's love to all. For the modernists, Christian social action and moral conduct, what was known as the social gospel, counted a great deal more than adherence to traditional doctrines. The social gospel, one of the founders instrumental in the social gospel had been Baptist theologian Walter Rauschenbusch, the social gospel movement had a particular emphasis on improving the quality of life for the urban poor. Mather must have encountered the social gospel as part of his involvement with the Baptists on the south side of Chicago, as well as in his undergraduate days at Chicago. Shaler Matthews' enthusiasm for the social gospel was unmistakable. Here we see Mather on the cover of his autobiography, New Faith for Old, which kind of tells you, in essence, what he was up to in his religious attitude and agenda. And as Mather later said, Shaler Matthews was, quote, one of my mother's heroes. Occasionally, he offered a special course on Sunday mornings for students in the arts and sciences on the study of the Bible. At Mother's suggestion, I took that course during a quarter in 1906 or 7. His approach was that of a modernist rather than a fundamentalist, and I found it highly informative and fascinating. That's Mather during his first 2 years of college. Mather also became very active in the Young Men's Christian Association, an organization serving the urban poor as a vital part of a broader religious ministry, and eventually he became the president of the American branch of the YMCA. Overall, Mather's thought combined a modernist understanding of God and the social gospel with a geologist's understanding of natural history. The key element in his views of God and nature came from Chamberlain, whose course on principles and theories of geology Mather sat through three times. The last time during his final year of graduate work. And here's what he said at that time, reflecting on this. It was during that year, and that's the same year in which he joined the Hyde Park Church and its theologically sophisticated milieu. He says, it's that same year that I began to comprehend more fully his rubric, the administration of the universe, a term that I later used with due acknowledgement to him. According to Mather, Chamberlain used it to mean that the universe is under some kind of administrative directive. Beg your pardon. The universe is under some kind of administrative regulation, whatever the administrative power may be. It implies only one thing about the nature of the administration, that it is unitary. Administration, not administrations. Significantly, administration is not spelled with a capital A in ordinary usage, nor is there any suggestion that administrator is an appropriate synonym. Such a conception, Mather said, resounds with some of the most majestic verses in the Book of Psalms and is essentially the basis for the philosophical complexities of Job. Human values, including cooperation and altruism, had emerged in just such a context. For, as Mather said, the administrative directive toward orderly organization of increasingly complex systems transcends the urge for survival. Judged in terms of the values which men customarily hold dear, he said, the conclusion seems clear that evolution has resulted in progress toward the attainment of the good, the true, and the beautiful. This is from a posthumous work, The Permissive Universe, which Stephen Jay Gould wrote the preface for. I'll have more to say about Gould at the very end. Gould and Mather were really tight. This is the closest he would come to affirming a grand teleology for the universe. He saw no geological evidence, quote, that a blueprint for man had been drafted on an architect's drawing board a half billion years ago, unquote. Or no hint that even 50 million years ago of any design to produce a creature in the precisely in the anatomical mold of man as he emerged in the glacial and post-glacial time. Think about Gould when you hear these things. Nevertheless, as he said on another occasion, there seems to be a direction in which life has moved, whether in obedience to orders from the rear or to enticements from out in front. Either way, there is an overall direction resulting ultimately in the emergence of an awareness of the non-material, the spiritual. As for humanity, the purpose of human evolution, he said, would seem to be the orderly organization of individuals who possess a sufficient dynamic of goodwill to cooperate with others and, quote, to use the rich resources of the bountiful earth for the welfare of the entire group. Now, Mather's morally progressive vision of evolution differed markedly from that of William Jennings analysts. This isn't Brian you're looking at here. This is Vernon Kellogg. Brian had been shocked by the way in which biologist Vernon Kellogg had linked the horrors of World War I to the teaching of Darwinism in Germany in his book Headquarters Nights. A little bit of background here for you. Kellogg was a distinguished American biologist. He was on the National Research Council, which was kind of the top dog of American scientific community at the time. He was also a neo-Lamarckian biologist, as were nearly all biologists of his generation. He had been educated in Germany, fluent in German. That'll be relevant here in a second. One of his former students, Herbert Hoover, was active before the United States got involved in World War I, was active in relief efforts for the civilian population of Europe. Kellogg followed Hoover to Europe during World War I, before America got involved. He was billeted in a house that was also serving as the headquarters of the German High Command in that part of Belgium. He had communication with German officers at dinner. He wrote about this in his book, Headquarters Nights, which had a preface by Theodore Roosevelt. And this particular book talks about how a certain German officer who had been a professor at the university before the war had closely linked the teaching of Darwinism in Germany with German militarism. They had conversations of this nature in the book. They also shocked Kellogg, but he put this in the book. Kellogg was a pacifist, and Bryan during World War I was a pacifist as well. This is what ultimately motivated Bryan to try to remove the teaching of evolution from public schools. This particular book and that particular agenda. Kellogg had already written in Atlantic Monthly magazine just before this book an article about the same ideas, and Atlantic Monthly Press published the book. Now that's all relevant because in Atlantic Monthly in 1918, Kirtley Mather published an article giving a completely different interpretation of the history of evolution. In an article of his own that was also published during the war, Mather took a fundamentally different route. Although he saw the same problem that Kellogg had seen, and he understood its religious implications. Here's what Mather said. Underneath the ancient warfare between theology and science, there's an unvoiced but very real fear that in the last analysis, the doctrine of the survival of the fittest and the struggle for existence is diametrically opposed to the conception of the brotherhood of man. That evolution, according to Darwin and de Vries and Weismann, is the antithesis of Christianity according to Christ and John and Paul. And Mather said later that he set out then to show that the evolutionary principle of the survival of the fittest in the struggle for existence is not in reality opposed to the Christian doctrine of the brotherhood of man and the supremacy of brotherly love. It was a theme with which I was concerned throughout many decades thereafter. One's first impression might be that eons of Earth history amounted to nothing more than the death struggle of the trilobites, he said, followed by the great reptiles, nature's grandest experiment at producing a master race by development along the line of brute strength and massive bulk. One might very well conclude, he said, that no good thing could ever come out of this welter of selfishness and greed, of worldly lusts and brute rivalry. Once the higher mammals appeared, however, the game was changed. The triumph of intelligence, agility, and brain power over brute strength, massive bulk, and sluggish mentality was complete. Now, Mather's optimism derived partly from the French philosopher Henri Bergson, author of Creative Evolution, a work that was very widely influential at the time. If you saw my article on Compton in our journal a few years ago, he also was very heavily influenced by Bergson. So were many others. In fact, contemporary Roman Catholic theologian John Haught told me once that the two most important theological influences on his work were Henri Bergson and Teilhard de Chardin. Now you can kind of put that together and maybe see where that's going. If you haven't read this work, you should take a look at it. Borrowing Bergson's own words, which I'm going to quote in a minute, that quotation there on the bottom of the slide is from Bergson, who Mather also quotes. Mather points out that in the evolution of life, just as in the evolution of human societies and of individual destinies, the greatest successes have been for those who have accepted the heaviest risks. Evolutionary progress had often come only when organisms had discarded apparent advantages. Instinct must give place to reason. Brute consciousness must develop into self-consciousness. Ultimately, humans evolved from the anthropoids, a transition made possible by three new traits: the habit of cooperation, the use of implements, and the knowledge of fire. Without all three of these, Mather wrote, no man-like creature could have survived. The emergence of our species then had depended on social instincts, and as he wrote, the experience of the past is the only key to unlock the future. In order to take the next step forward in the progress of life, we must, he said, develop race consciousness and love. Now, when he says race consciousness, he's not talking about white, black, etc. He's talking about the human race, collectively, okay? Race consciousness and love. The type of the new variety of the human species was presented to us 1,900 years ago. You can figure out who that is. He said elsewhere, the Christian has assumed that Jesus of Nazareth displayed the true character of the administration of the universe. And here he did capitalize administration of the universe. On the eve of World War II, he was still saying similar things, and I'm going to have to skip this part. In an address he gave in Upland, Pennsylvania at Crozer Seminary, he wrote an essay called The Natural History of Righteousness. Now, if that intrigues you, you have to go look at my paper. Okay, so let me skip ahead here a little bit. Okay. After World War II, Mather served as president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 1951. Five of the authors of these pamphlets I'm looking at, of the 10 pamphlets, were AAAS presidents at one time or another. Mather is the one who was least well-known of those five. He also served as president of the other AAAS, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, from 1957 to 1961. And he was also the book review editor for American Scientists for many, many years. These positions only increased his visibility and influence among scientifically educated Americans. His views on science and religion were very widely known, but they clearly posed no barriers then to holding high offices such as these. In fact, between 1925, that's the year of the Scopes trial, and 1960, roughly when evolution gets a high profile again in high school biology texts, numerous presidents of the AAAS were active members of Christian churches. The precise number is not known to me. And some of the most accomplished were also markedly liberal theologically. Physicists Robert Millikan and Arthur Compton, both Nobel laureates, would certainly be in this group. According to a study of what's called, the article is called, Scientific Eminence and Church Membership, 1931, eminent scientists were far more likely to be Unitarians, Congregationalists, Quakers, or Universalists, while Baptists, Lutherans, and Roman Catholics were at the bottom, if the relative sizes of each group were taken into consideration. The authors of the study concluded that members of those former denominations, the liberal denominations, had, quote, relative freedom in interpreting biblical pronouncements and flexibility in reacting to questions such as fundamentalism, the virgin birth, etc. This is a quote from the article. Even though Mather was a lifelong Baptist, one of the groups on the other end, his religious attitude fits this description to a T. No less significant was the role Mather played in the early years of the Institute on Religion in an Age of Science. IRAS, the organization that later published the journal Zygon, was created in 1954 by two of his best friends, the Unitarian scholar Ralph Wendell Burho, who taught at the seminary, Meadville Seminary in Chicago, though he was originally from New England, and he had been Mather's secretary at the other AAAS for the time Mather was president, and Harlow Shapley, the famous Harvard astronomer who was Owen Gingerich's dissertation advisor, PI, whatever you call him in science. Humanities, you'd say the dissertation advisor. Shapley and Burho held conceptions of God that were not much different from Mather's administrator. Burho shared Mather's view that evolution involves more than competition and that altruism is the crucial factor in the survival of humanity. Mather himself didn't found IRAS, but he was a regular speaker at their Star Island summer conferences and also contributed articles to the early issues of Zygon. I got one paragraph to go. In this respect, Mather was a crucial figure in the modern history of religion and science. He functioned as a personal and intellectual bridge between the Protestant modernists of the early 20th century and their spiritual descendants of the 1950s and 60s, the same group of people who went on to create the modern dialogue of religion and science. Some secular scientists also respected him and appreciated what he was trying to do. No one more than late Stephen Jay Gould, who shared Mather's emphasis on cooperation rather than competition in evolution. I sometimes wonder, although I have no evidence for this, it's just a wonder, I sometimes wonder whether Gould's Numa view of science and religion, in which science respects the kind of religion that disavows miracles and defines its area as a realm of values, reflects an influence from Mather. He used to have Mather come into his class at Harvard every year and talk about the Scopes trial. And he also preached the eulogy for Mather at the Harvard Chapel. Okay, now, even more, Gould once said that Mather is, quote, perhaps the finest man that I have ever known. And, you know, Gould was not a person who spoke about most people in that way, okay? And described Mather as, quote, one of those rare men of enlarged curiosity, which, as you see from the parenthesis part of the quotation, has a history for that quotation, who grace our planet from time to time and who try to integrate the many compartments of our too specialized world into a coherent vision of life worth living. In short, Mather was one of the pivotal figures in the history of religion and science in modern America. Thanks for your attention.
We're essentially out of time, so I'm going to dismiss those of you that need to go, but if you'd like to stick around for a few minutes for questions, that's what.
Yeah, I'd like you to take a minute and let people leave if they want to go somewhere else, and then...